Would you turn with me now to Psalm 90 at verse 12? Psalm 90 at verse 12. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. The author of this psalm is Moses, as we noticed from the title, A Prayer of Moses, the Man of God. We would be safe then to say that this is the oldest psalm in the book of Psalms, one of the oldest portions indeed of the Bible itself, because the first writer of the Bible was Moses. I find it very interesting that that should be the case. No Bible books were written in the days before the flood, when people lived to be almost 1,000 years of age. No Bible books were written in the days of Abraham, when people were still living to be 180 and so forth. The first Bible books which were written when God had made the age of man normal. That is to say, he had reduced it to what is now normal, 70 years of age, possibly 80 years of age. Now, this was something new in the history of the world at that time. Before this date, people lived to much greater ages, as you know. For instance, just to develop the point very quickly and without being at all lengthy on it, Methuselah lived to be 969 years. He was the oldest man who ever lived. Now that's about 13 or 14 times older than we would have a life expectation today. So these patriarchs lived to be nearly 1,000. That's 13 generations older than we would live today. But God caused the Bible to begin to be written at a time when the age and lifespan was, as it is still, 70 or 80 years. When you look at this psalm as a whole, you see how very, very different is the outlook and the mentality here from that of the modern world, even the modern religious world. This is a sad psalm. It makes no pretense about the realities of life and death and sin and the wrath of God. Terrible words there that Moses has. Who knows the power of thy wrath? That means to say, nobody has any conception as to what God will do with sinners in hell. We have never dreamed how God will smash them in pieces and break their image down and crush them with eternal damnation. No, that's what Moses means. We haven't any idea. The nearest we get to it is when we see how our blessed Savior, our representative, was damned for us. There is the measure of the wrath of God. There is the yardstick, dare I use it, for measuring the wrath and curse of God, that not even his own beloved Son was spared when he stood as the substitute for the church, for us. So let us not run away with the impression that these days are right when they trivialize religion, or that these days are right when they go soft on the doctrine of sin and the doctrine of eternal punishment. These are not virtues, these are distortions. Real religion is as it is written in this book, as Moses gives it us here, and all the other writers We mustn't change the emphases that God has given. No matter how unpalatable they are to modern man who likes to think of fun and smiles and cheer and happiness and backslapping, we mustn't change the message to suit men's tastes. Well, now that said, I want to look at the text, which is verse 12, and I give you my headings so you see where I want to go. First of all, I want to explain a little as to what it means to number our days. Teach us to number our days. That's the first consideration. What does it mean to number our days? Second, I want to say how God does this, how he teaches us this, because this is something which we don't know until he teaches us. No man knows how to number his days until God teaches him. So says Moses, teach us, oh, teach us to number our days. So the second heading will be to say how God does that. And then the third point is, what is the wisdom which this brings to us? Teach us so to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. What is this wisdom which men get? I think that is a logical and a fair opening of the text. I give you my headings again. First of all, I want to look at the subject of numbering our days, what that means. Second, how God teaches men to number their days. And thirdly, what is the wisdom which we gain when God, in his grace, teaches us to number our days? Taking that as the order then, first of all, let me say, what does it mean to number our days? Well, part of the answer is, it means to recognize that life is very short. Somebody has calculated, I'm not sure how, that as Moses was leading the children of Israel through the desert during those 40 years, at least 15,000 people would have needed to be buried. As I say, I don't know how that calculation was arrived at, but I found it in an old commentary. It may be roughly right. At least 15,000 people. So over the 40-year period, Moses and the Israelites, they were faced with this duty, day after day, several times a day, burying their dead. And you see how this message was imprinted upon their minds and upon Moses' mind. Now, you will know that the Bible employs many illustrations to bring home to our hearts the brevity of life. Man's life is like the grass. Here it is in this psalm. Grows up in the morning, flourishes in the evening, and then is cut down. Another biblical illustration is that of the leaf. Isaiah 64. We all do fade as a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind have carried us away. It's so true, isn't it? Here we are now in autumn again. It seems that last week when the leaves were beginning to appear again on the trees in the spring, but half a year has gone. The leaves are withering and falling. So is the life of every man and woman, and sometimes also child. Again, the Bible compares our life to a mist which appears for a little time and then vanishes away, and you don't see it. You open the curtains in the morning and there's mist upon the hill. By lunchtime, the mist has evaporated and gone. So is the life of man. Or again, Psalm 39, thou hast made my days an handbreadth. Well, that's not very much, is it? If you needed to measure the distance from here to Edinburgh in handbreadths, it would take a long time to do it. A handbreadth is just a few inches, 6, 7, 8, 9, depending upon whether it be a younger person or a grown man or whatever. A handbreadth, so in the eyes of God, is the life of man. And all of this Moses compares and contrasts with the life of God when he says that God's Age is as a thousand years is but as yesterday when it is gone. From everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man to destruction. If you and I had eyes to see it and lived long enough to know it, the children of Adam are pouring into the grave like a vast waterfall. And indeed, speaking of water, what is said in the Old Testament but just that? That our life is as water that is spilt on the ground, that cannot be gathered up again. We live in a sad world, and we cannot pretend otherwise. And that is what is meant here by numbering our days, to recognize that fact. My very dear friends, we live in a world where people do not recognize that fact. They know it to be a truth. Scientists, researchers, scholars, mathematicians, they know that to be a truth. They don't expect to live more than about 80 years at best, 82 maybe, 90 if they're very fortunate, as they say, but not much more than that at the very, very most. And yet, what use do they make of that knowledge? I'm not quoting Calvin exactly, but Calvin has an interesting comment like this in his book on the Psalms, his commentary on the Psalms, I believe. He says this. He says, you have great scholars, and they spend all their life calculating the distance from the earth to the sun, and from this planet to that planet, and calculating how many miles from the circumference of the earth to the center of the earth, and from here to the moon. But they don't think of the shortness of their own life. Now that brings it home rather vividly. Great and good Calvin, there he is. How powerfully he makes the point. We have people in laboratories measuring things by milliliters and milligrams of this and powder of that, and they're skillful in their mathematics and in their science, and that's good, of course, but they're forgetting their own life is so short. Do we remember what Thomas Chalmers said, the great disruption leader, when he was converted? He was a mathematician and a scientist, you know, and when he was converted, somebody said to him, you know, what about the mathematics now? He was busy preparing sermons all the time. He saw something far more important. It was the expulsive power of a new affection, the desire to save souls. Oh, he said, my friend, I forgot, in my unconverted days, I forgot two things. The magnitude of eternity and the shortness of life. These are the two great mathematical factors which I now see to be important. Oh, my beloved friends, let us recall that our life is short. 60, or if by reason of strength, 80, and yet that extra bit often brings infirmity of body, weakness of mind, loss of memory. Not always, thank God, especially not in these days when we have so many medications to help us. But at best, our life is but short. So, that's what's meant by numbering our days. Numbering our days. And I would say to myself, as I say to you, oh, may we number our days. And not forget, in the midst of the hurry and bustle of life, to keep this ever before us, our life is short at best. I was very fond of Innes McRae, the minister who was in Tain for those years and retired to Inverness. He was an excellent minister, an excellent friend, a very spiritually minded man, a very clear thinker too. He came to retire to Inverness a few years ago, as you remember, many of you, and his life went down like that. It was amazing to see how quickly, from being a fit and active man, he went down with this disease. Oh, friends, let us number our days. Now, second, what we have to consider is, how does God teach us this lesson? Because, I've said already, it is a lesson that people do not, of themselves, ever learn. How many people are thinking about the length of their days? No, they're not. They're thinking about everything else. Everything and nothing. And vanity. They can tell you the names of all the sportsmen from Manchester to London and back to Edinburgh. They can tell you the scores of all the matches round the country. Second, third, fourth division, however many divisions they are. They know the scores. They can tell you how many horses there are on this race and what the betting is on that race. But they don't think of their own short life. They're not numbering their days. So let us be clear about this. If you and I are numbering our days, it's not thanks to any wisdom of ours. For we never do it. We never do it, I say, until God graciously teaches us. And how he teaches us is in this way. First and foremost, by his holy word. Oh, blessed Bible, blessed book which tells us these things. Painful as the lessons are, the Bible explains to us, why is it that man dies? Why do we die at all? When we walk in the woods, we see trees that have been there for generations. Huge, towering trees, several hundred years old. Sometimes the people of a former generation carved their initials on the trees, and they've long since gone, these people. The trees are there. And that's very humbling. And the Bible alone is the place we go to discover the reason for this. It is that God reckons the first sin of the first man to be the sin of all his children. The imputation of Adam's first sin. That's why our life is short. And that's why we must die. And God tells us and teaches us that in his holy word. Now, God teaches us this also by experiences. Only at our conviction and conversion do we take to heart the fact of the shortness of life. The Bible itself that informs us of these things doesn't convince us of the seriousness of the subject until we ourselves are converted. We must experience the saving grace of God. Conviction of sin, conversion, which is the work of God, all of that is necessary in order that we might learn this great lesson. But the experiences of grace, having fellowship with the Lord's people, also teaches us the same thing. We learn in the church lessons that you don't learn out of the church. We learn that there are older Christians who've gone before us, and we miss them when they go. And we miss their example, elders whom we loved. When they go, they leave a gulf and a gap, which instructs us and teaches us this very lesson, the shortness of life, the magnitude of eternity. And God has ordained it to be exactly like that. Now, one of the experiences of grace that God gives to his people is when he converts them to himself, he begins to turn their minds round from the vanities and follies of this world to consider life from the standpoint of truth. There's no better illustration of this that I can think of than the life of John Bunyan. John Bunyan, when he was a young man, was fond of foolish games. And one day, you may remember, he was in his native village in England, and he was walking past some old women who were sitting on seats outside their houses, or they weren't so much houses as little cottages. And he overheard them talking. And they were talking about things the like of which he'd never heard in his life. They were talking about being born again, and knowing God. And he listened in. He'd never heard, as I say, he'd never heard a conversation like this ever in his life. And he realized that there were things he'd never dreamed about. Conversion, knowing God. And he came under conviction of sin. Now the effect of that was, when he was turned to Christ himself, look how he used his life. Pilgrim's Progress, the Holy War, grace abounding. And you could go on. 60 books he wrote in 60 years of his life. 60 years, 60 books. Now that's an instance in which you see of how God had taught this dear man the value of his precious time. Oh, teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. And that's perfectly illustrated in the case of that beloved tinker, as we call him, John Bunyan. He had next to no education. Certainly nothing but the very basics, but a born genius who wrote some of the greatest books that ever a man has ever written in the history of the world. How did it happen? He was taught of God. The experiences of grace. The Bible is the best university of all. And those who know everything except the Bible really in the end know nothing. Certainly nothing which is of ultimate transcendental importance. What they know is all right as far as it goes. But the experiences of grace are the method whereby God teaches us the shortness of life. Let me come on. God teaches us also by the mistakes of others. Why did Christ tell us the parable of the rich fool? But for this reason. Do you recall the parable? A rich man whose barns were too small to contain all his grain broke them down and built bigger barns and crammed all the grain inside. And then he said to his soul, "Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him that very night, "Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall these things be?" And Christ tells us that, obviously, to make us realize the shortness of our life and to use the bit of it we've got left in a wiser way than that unhappy man did. So, the mistakes of others, my dear friends, sadly, with tears let us say it, all around us people are living the life of the rich fool. Not all of them rich, but sadly, all around us people are building with straw. And with the muckrake, to use Bunyan's phrase, raking a little bit of dust into a pile, a little bit of money, a little bit of property, a little bit of this and that. Nothing that's going to last or take them to a happy world above. Oh, the sadness of this world. Oh, the sadness of this generation. But God also teaches us this lesson by removing our loved ones from us. Let me come back to this point. I mentioned it. Let me come back to it. You know, when God takes our loved ones from us, it's as though he is, as it were, striking off part of our own body, a hand or a foot. When we lose loved ones, Christian loved ones, family loved ones, it makes us see the shortness of this present world, the vanity of all things under the sun. We see things in a different light. Oh, let us have grace to number our days. Let us have grace to look at life realistically. Let us have grace, my friends, to apply our hearts unto wisdom, which is my third and final point. What is this wisdom? Well, the wisdom is to see the preciousness of time. The preciousness of what's the most valuable thing you and I have? Is it the gold watch that came down to us from Uncle so-and-so? No, the most precious thing we have is time. Did you ever hear of the name of a missionary in the early 20th century? His name was Borden of Yale. Borden of Yale. Yale is in America. He was an American. A very, very, very rich young man. But when he was converted through Reuben Finney, Reuben Torrey, what this man did was this. He gave away his fortune, which was $1 million. And by modern standards, that would probably be more like $100 million. He gave it all away for missionary work. And he devoted himself to preparing for the foreign mission field, to go to China. But on the way, he went to Egypt in order to learn Arabic. And he contracted a serious illness and died, a very young man. But I remember that this is something he said once. This is how he valued his life. He said, each day consists of 24 golden hours. Each hour consists of 60 diamond-studded minutes. That was how he thought of time. And he wasted none of it. He was always either reading the Bible, or studying about it, or meditating on it, or praying to God, the whole of his short life. Now that's the secret of all these men. Take Robert Murray McShane, than whom there isn't a better example. Our beloved McShane, our beloved Scottish McShane, from St. Peter's Dundee, that wonderful man of God, died at the age of 29. His life was like several generations. And yet he was only 29. And he influenced the whole nation, the whole world has been influenced for good by McShane. How did it happen? Well, the answer's in Psalm 61. Like many generations be the years that he shall live. If a man uses his time well to the glory of God, his influence is beyond all telling. And that's what's true of McShane. You could add Henry Martin, who went to the Middle East as a missionary. You could add many others. William Carey, who certainly did not die young, but his influence in India was profound. He and his colleagues, when they went to India, translated the New Testament into over 30 languages. Can you believe it? The whole subcontinent of India received the Bible in their own languages, over 30 of them, by this one man and his few colleagues. And a smart Englishman once tried to humble William Carey by saying, Mr. Carey, when you were back home in England, they say you were just a shoemaker, nothing more. That was meant to be a snub. And Carey looked back at him. No, he said, I wasn't even a shoemaker. I was just a little cobbler, he said. And this little cobbler used to say, all I do is I keep on doing the bit that I can do. Keep plodding on. That's all I can do. I can plod, he said. Do you see what he did? Plodding. He gave all his New Testaments to the Indian subcontinent. And an inspiration to all the generations that would come after. This is what's meant by the wisdom in my text. Applying our hearts to wisdom. Oh, the wisdom is to use what time we have to the glory of God. Be it much or little, let it be used to the glory of God. That's what's being meant here. Look at the life of Calvin. Calvin died in his 50s. He didn't reach 60, he was about 56, about that age. And when you go to a theological library, the books he wrote would go from one end of my arm to the other, like that. Over 60 books. Spurgeon the same. Spurgeon, his sermons were coming out for maybe 20 years or so after he died. Every year a volume of Spurgeon's sermons was coming out for about 15 or 20 years after his death. That shows the fruitfulness of the man. It shows how he wasted nothing. Well now, what is the evidence that you and I are growing in this wisdom? What is the proof of it that you and I are really taking seriously the wisdom that is talked about in this text? Well, one sign whereby we can test ourselves is this. If you and I are living an ordered life, that's the test. That's one test, an ordered life. Oh, friends, those who take time seriously and their life seriously and they intend to live to the glory of God, they live an ordered life. I wonder if you ever ask yourself the question, why do the chimes on our big clocks, why do these clocks chime every quarter of an hour? Who invented that chime every quarter of an hour? Maybe you never thought of it. Like the Westminster chimes, you know those beautiful chimes you get in big clocks? They chime every quarter. Well, I'm told it was the Puritans who invented that. And it wasn't an accident. The Puritans were so concerned with using time and not wasting a moment of time that they devised a method for the clock to chime every quarter. So they'd be reminded, time is going on, waste none of it. And they didn't waste much of it. They would rise early, on their knees, then their Bibles, then their families, then their children catechized, and so on. And the same at night, Sabbath and weekday, in the service, never out of the house of God, when health and strength permitted, always in their place of duty. The house of God, morning and evening, the prayer meeting, all these things. Now I say this because, you see, this is one way that shows that we're growing in this wisdom that is spoken of here. Oh, so teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Did you ever think of it this way? There's a sense in which the Christian life is better on earth than it will be in heaven. Just one way, only one way. And what is it you say? Well, it's this. In heaven, your reward will be fixed. You can't increase it. You will be given a reward according as your life has been as a Christian in this world. The more you glorify God in this world, the greater your reward in heaven. But you see, there's a sense in which we're better off in this world than in heaven, in this sense only that we can still do more for God whilst we're here. We can increase our heavenly reward. As Jesus said, lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Why? How can you do that? Well, by glorifying Him here on earth. You see how it works? There's a sense that that's not original to me, that thought, but it is a true thought. In France at the time of the Reformation, there was a man called Olivier Ton. His name means olive oil. It was a nickname. It wasn't his real name. Nickname, olive oil. And why did they call this man olive oil? Seems a funny thing to call a man, doesn't it? I'll tell you. It's because he was always putting olive oil into his little lamp. He was always studying the Word of God, studying the Word of God. He helped to translate the Bible into French, olivaton, olive oil, always working. Well, my dear friends, we can't do what some of these great men have done, that's true. But let us do what our time and strength and health will permit. Oh, to do something for God. To have a well-ordered life. So to live our days that when we come to the end of our days, we can look back and we can say, I did a little, it wasn't much, but I did what I could. Do you remember what was said about dear Mary when she anointed the Lord with oil? Well, perhaps it wasn't a world-shaking event, but what she did was a beautiful gesture. She has anointed me against the day of burying. Leave her alone, he said to the disciples, who criticized her. She hath done what she could. And my dear friends, that's a wonderful, sweet commendation from Christ. My dearest wish is that that should be true of every one of you and of all the Lord's people. They have done what they could. Teach us so to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. God help us so to do.